First, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me. So it's really a pleasure to be here. It's been a wonderful conference. So why should we worry about the Tractatus? Did Wittgenstein think it was a largely mistaken work? Isn't his important work his later work? And doesn't his later work consist in a rejection of his earlier views? So doesn't the interest of the Tractatus mostly lie in its capacity to furnish an example of the sort of philosophy that Wittgenstein was most concerned to have us not do, that is, what he was most against in philosophy? Now, most of the secondary literature on Wittgenstein either implicitly or explicitly answers these questions in the affirmative. And my aim today is not, as David Stern's talk may have led you to suppose, that what I think we should do is instead answer them in the negative. But rather, what I want us to do is get clear about what, if we do want to answer them in the affirmative, ought to be affirmed. Bring out the difficulty of the questions themselves. Now, as some of you know, as was just indicated, there's currently a debate going on about how to read, especially the Tractatus, or at least that's how the debate is often formulated, as a debate about how to read the Tractatus, that itself is an artifact, I think, of certain forms of publication. And this paper isn't going to attempt a direct contribution to that debate. But I think it is natural to think, I think many of the people, at least on one side of the debate, think that all that ought to be at stake in that debate is a fairly parochial question concerning the interpretation of Wittgenstein's work at one phase of his career, relatively early phase. And so it's natural to conclude that whatever differences may divide parties to this debate concerning how to read the Tractatus, nonetheless, au fond, these interpreters of Wittgenstein may be in broad agreement about how to read most of the rest of Wittgenstein's work, which is part of what can lead to the conclusion that if there aren't two, there must be one Wittgenstein. Or at least to the assumption that whatever the disagreements may be about in the early work, disagreeing about that doesn't preclude that they're ones that can be independently adjudicated without substantial cost to anyone's views about how to read the later work. And so one burden of this talk today is to suggest that that assumption is mistaken, and to suggest that issues parallel to those which arise in the interpretation of the Tractatus arise in connection with the interpretation of Wittgenstein's later work as well. So it no longer seems to be a debate about, shall we say, one or two Wittgensteins, but about how to see the aspect under which remarks of Wittgenstein should be seen regardless of where they occur in his work. So this is, therefore, I suppose, a paper about possible continuities and discontinuities in Wittgenstein's philosophy. Now, what I'm going to do first, in the first part of the question, is quickly try to sketch some of the central exegetical assumptions common to fairly standard readings of the Tractatus, and I just pick a famous example, the private language sections of the investigations. There's a third part of this paper about uncertainty, and fitting it into those parallels. I'm going to skip that part of the paper in the interest of time. In order to just even engage in this sketch quickly enough, I'm going to have to settle for descriptions of the relevant readings of these parts of Wittgenstein's work that operate at a severely severe level of abstraction. In particular, I'm going to have to abstract from matters about which the relevant community of readers disagree, because what I want to try to do is bring out their fundamental points of agreement in order to bring out what the fundamental continuity in Wittgenstein's philosophy is as that continuity emerges on standard readings of his work. And then I'm going to go on briefly in conclusion today to indicate why I think there may be reason to think that the fundamental assumptions thus standardly attributed to Wittgenstein are, first of all, already under indictment in the Tractatus, and why there's reason to think that that indictment continues to remain in force as one moves to his later work. So on this portrait, you have a criticism of a fairly standard reading of later Wittgenstein, already an early Wittgenstein. So that leaves the question of how many Wittgensteins you'll end up with quite undetermined. So my overall hope is to offer a brief view of an overall picture of where at least one strain of continuity in Wittgenstein's philosophy might be thought to lie. And I think it emerges in the opposite place from where we've standardly been taught to look for it by much of the commentary, as a prolegomena to then being able to raise questions about where the real discontinuities are. If there is a criticism of the Tractatus, what is he criticizing and what are the criticisms? I'm going to just take as a sample a passage from Gordon Baker and Peter Hacker, from that Gordon Baker and Peter Hacker. And this passage, I hope, will just suffice to give a brief indication of the sort of account of the continuity in Wittgenstein's philosophy that I have in mind here as my foil. And I think that passage offers a fairly standard appeal story of how an appeal to logical syntax in the Tractatus is supposed to give way in later Wittgenstein to an appeal to rules of grammar. Here's the quotation from Baker and Hacker. Quote, Wittgenstein had, in the Tractatus, seen that philosophical or conceptual investigation moves in the domain of rules. An important point of continuity was the insight that philosophy is not concerned with what is true and what is false, but rather with what makes sense and what traverses the bounds of sense. What he called rules of grammar are the direct descendants of the rules of logical syntax of the Tractatus. Like the rules of logical syntax, rules of grammar determine the bounds of sense. They distinguish sense from nonsense. Grammar, as Wittgenstein understood the term, is the account book of language. Its rules determine the limits of sense, and by carefully scrutinizing, the philosopher may determine at what point he has drawn an overdraft on reason, violated the rules for the use of an expression, and so, in subtle and in not so readily identifiable ways, traverse the bounds of sense. Now, I agree with Baker and Hacker that the later conception of grammar is, in some ways, the heir of the earlier conception of logical syntax. And I also agree with their general proposal concerning the general region of Wittgenstein's thought in which one most fruitfully looks for significant continuity, namely his conceptions of grammar or logic, and what failures thereof amount to, or what nonsense is, and in his concomitant conceptions of philosophical method. But I'm going to want to disagree with their particular characterizations of these conceptions, as, for example, turning on an aspiration to formulate rules that determine the limits of sense, and thus determine at what point the philosopher traverses those bounds, a point reached when the philosopher violates the rules for the use of an expression. Now, characterizations like those, I think, are to be found in much of the secondary literature on Wittgenstein. The question I want to ask is, how faithful are they to Wittgenstein's own conception of what he was trying to accomplish in philosophy, early or late? I'll begin with a brief sketch of a fairly standard reading of the Tractatus. It turns on a particular way of understanding the distinction between what can be said in language and what can only be shown. The logical form which a proposition shares with the bit of reality that it depicts, we are told, cannot itself be made the subject of depiction. Rather, it's shown in the proposition which possesses it. And in the standard way of understanding this, the logical form ends up being conceived of as a sort of something, a something which stands in a certain sort of relation to a proposition. And so it comes to look as if there's something like facts about what propositions depict. It looks like it's a fact that this proposition has that logical form. Having said this much, though, already at a very early stage in their exposition, most proponents of the standard reading of the Tractatus are going to feel some need to begin to backpedal. So they'll say, well, actually it's not a fact, but perhaps rather a fact, placing the word in quotation marks, that this proposition has that logical form. So some of them think it helps to actually call what's here at issue a fact, placing the word fact in quotes, to mark the difference between such facts and real, ordinary, garden variety facts. Facts, in that ordinary sense, are what can be spoken of, what can be depicted by meaningful propositions. What's at issue here is not that sort of fact, but something much deeper. Something? Well, not something. It's much deeper than a fact or a thing. It's like a fact, in that we can, in our thinking about it, get it right or wrong. But it's at too deep a level, deeper than any ordinary fact, to be a mere fact. So I propose we call those matters, which according to this thinking, according to this reading of the Tractatus, our thought aims to get right when it seeks to grasp the structure of thought or language of this deeper domain, that we call these things quasi-facts. Now on this reading, on the standard reading, our language cannot depict quasi-facts, because quasi-facts have to do with what language itself can or cannot depict. That our language cannot depict quasi-facts seems to come into view as a limitation on our language. And it might be taken to be a merely contingent limitation, one that might be overcome by rising, say, to the level of a meta-language, as Russell suggested in his introduction to the Tractatus. And according to the standard reading, the Wittgensteinian response to such a Russellian suggestion, at least in his early work, is to insist that the limitation in question is a necessary one. To insist in attempting to frame propositions about logical form, we're attempting to state the essential presuppositions of any meaningful language. And to treat this as a fact that could be represented in some language or other is to pose that there could be a language which could accommodate the possibility of the alleged fact not obtaining. And such a language would be an illogical language. And the whole point of the Tractatus is, according to the standard reading, to show that such a language is something that cannot be. And it's not just something that for some contingent reason cannot be. The non-contingent character of the impossibility at issue here is to be made manifest to us through our realizing that when we try to speak of what it is we imagine we might be able to say in such a language, one in which it would be possible to speak of such quasi-facts, we end up speaking nonsense. And so we come to see that any attempt to put into words what it is we want to say, when attempting to speak of the essential presuppositions of any meaningful language, must necessarily violate the conditions that render meaningful discourse possible. And if the Tractatus is read in this fairly standard manner, then it seems to me to be open to a charge of self-made. The procedure of the book as a whole, insofar as it allows itself to talk of how logical form is shown, presupposes the possibility of just the sort of language that it also seeks to show is impossible. And such a charge is difficult to forestall, I think, as soon as the difficulty posed by the following question comes sharply into focus. Is the thought that an illogical language is impossible itself a thought or not? Is it something thinkable? On the most influential line of interpretation, Wittgenstein's solution to this problem is to relocate it to the realm of the unsayable. So the book is read as attempting to hint at what it cannot by its own light say, that there's a realm of ineffable fact-like quasi-truths, such as the fact-like quasi-truth, that language and world share a common logical form. On this view, the propositions of Tractatus, while strictly speaking nonsense, can serve a useful purpose by directing our attention to the ineffable features of reality and language that undergird meaningful discourse. And in this way, they enable us to see the world aright. So the difficulty is transformed from one concerning what we can think and say into one concerning whether certain sorts of ineffable contents can be shown or grasped. And usually the appearance that the difficulty has been surmounted thereby is generated by introducing a device of equivocation. I've already mentioned one such device, the device of putting expressions in quotation marks. Fact, truth, grasp, express. So that one can deploy a concept and at the same time deny that one is employing the concept in question, without ever having to make it clear what concept it is that one is thereby employing, if not the one which figures in quotes. Another favorite device is the very handy locution, strictly speaking. Look at commentaries of the Tractatus and count how many times this expression, either in English or in Latin, appears. If the illusionary propositions of the Tractatus are nonsense, then how do we understand them? Well, they are, strictly speaking, nonsense. For after all, the Tractatus does say they're nonsense. But they're not mere nonsense. They're a form of deep nonsense, by means of which a special sort of message can be conveyed. Well, is what such a proposition conveys a thought? Well, actually, it's not strictly speaking a thought. The Tractatus, after all, says that thought is the significant proposition. But it's like a thought, in that one person can communicate it to another, and we can grasp what is thus meant. Well, in what sense do we grasp what is thus meant? Are we able to understand that which the proposition is trying and failing to say? Well, strictly speaking, we don't understand it. The Tractatus, after all, says to understand a proposition is to know what is the case, if it's true. But it's like understanding a proposition, except in this case, there is nothing that is the case for us to understand. Does the Tractatus itself distinguish between mere nonsense that has no meaning and deep nonsense whose intended meaning we can thus grasp? Well, perhaps in not so many words, but the distinction is required, we are told, in order to make sense of what the Tractatus does want to say. If only you could. Does the Tractatus itself distinguish between mere thoughts that are the contents of significant propositions and deep thoughts that outrun the limits of language? Well, not in so many words, but the distinction is told, is required, we are told by commentators, in order to make sense of what the Tractatus again would want to say, if only you could. And so it comes to pass that Wittgenstein's work seems to stand in desperate need of the assistance of his commentators in order for it to even appear to be able to stand on its own feet. Now, I'm going to refer to readings of the Tractatus that dither in this manner, both in their treatment of the philosophical problems themselves and in their degree of willingness to credit the Tractatus with having thought its own problems all the way through, as irresolute readings of the Tractatus. And as I said at the outset, it's not my aim today to argue directly for or against such readings. My aim is simply to bring out how these readings align with certain alternatives for reading later Wittgenstein. But since I do think such irresolute readings fail to do justice to Wittgenstein's early work, I'm going to allow myself to say that the parallel readings of his later work describe pseudo-Tractarian doctrines to later Wittgenstein. Now, on the standard reading of the so-called private language argument, Wittgenstein's aim is to show, one, that the possibility of language use rests on certain conditions, two, that a private language does not satisfy these conditions, and therefore, three, that such a language is impossible. Now, if there's actually an argument of just this form to be found in the text, I think it's really buried quite handsomely underneath quite a few digressions and distractions. But the quantity of secondary literature that's been devoted to excavating it at least testifies to the extent to which it's a near universal article of faith, that it's lying there somewhere underneath waiting to be excavated. There are a great many differences of interpretation about the details of the supposed argument, disagreements about what the relevant conditions are, about why a private language falls short of just these conditions, and hence about why such a language is impossible. But none of these differences of interpretation will matter, at least most of them won't matter for my purposes. What I want to bring out is what almost all such interpretations have in common with one another. They all take Wittgenstein to be trying to show us that there is something that cannot be a private language. And the reason that it cannot be rests upon a conception of the necessary conditions of the possibility of any language and what it would be to transgress these. The essential preconditions of our language, now at issue, now that we've turned to the work of later Wittgenstein, tend to get called something different, grammatical truths. We don't want to call them principles of logical syntax anymore. And grammatical propositions are taken to be propositions that say something true. And some of the standard ways of evading or almost confronting the issue of what sort of truth attaches to them, I think really ought to remind them of the standard ways of understanding and evading the issue of what sort of pseudo-Tractarian quasi-fact it is that a particular proposition has this or that logical form. Again, a discomfort arises here in connection with how we should conceive the nature of the something, which a certain sort of proposition, which is not an ordinary factual proposition, asserts to be the case. And here, as before, there's a great deal of wavering in the commentary when it comes to facing this issue. I don't mean self-conscious wavering. I mean, look at what's said, and you'll see it's moving around. Again, already at an early point in the game, many commentators will feel some need to backpedal from what I've just said they say. Only now, most of them think they have to backpedal in what at least sounds like a different direction. They no longer want to retreat from the asserting of philosophical truths, be they logical or grammatical, to a mere pseudo-Tractarian showing of them. Yet in grasping that there cannot be a private language, they still want there to be something that they grasp. We're told that what's at issue here is a grammatical truth rather than an empirical truth. And in most readings, the quasi-fact that our ordinary factual discourse cannot lay hold of this sort of truth can first seem to come into view as a kind of limitation on our language. Only now it is sometimes taken by some commentators to be a merely contingent limitation, one which might be overcome by switching, say, to a different language or form of life. And according to such readers of later Wittgenstein, who I think have almost no counterparts among scholars of the Tractatus, a fundamental change in the grammatical structure of our language or in our form of life might indeed furnish us with the linguistic or conceptual resources able to accommodate sorts of fact that the present grammar of our language forbids our being able to countenance. So these readers of later Wittgenstein, like Russell in his introduction to the Tractatus, take the necessities of logic and grammar that Wittgenstein runs up against in his philosophizing to be ones that we are able to transcend simply by enriching or exchanging our linguistic resources. And they therefore, though they may be reluctant to acknowledge the point, take later Wittgenstein to have made progress over his early self through having given way to Russell on the essential point, albeit while differing with him over the details concerning what sort of linguistic enrichment might be required. According to other readers of later Wittgenstein, the proper response to this, we might call it anthropologistic variant of Russell's suggestion, is to insist that the truths disclosed by grammatical investigation are indeed necessary. To insist that if, for example, attempting to frame truths about, say, the public nature of language use, we're attempting to state presuppositions of any language whatsoever. And if the truths disclosed by grammatical investigation were indeed mere truths about us and about how we cannot help but think, or about our language and the way it forces us to carve up the world, or about our culture and the forms of thinking into which it traps us, then Wittgenstein's view would collapse into some form of psychologism, relativism, linguistic idealism. And these readers of later Wittgenstein will insist that that's just what Wittgenstein most sought to avoid. To treat that which grammatical remarks bring to light about, for example, the public nature of languages as a mere fact about our language, as these first readers of Wittgenstein do, is to suppose that there could be a language which could accommodate the possibility of this fact's not obtaining. But the very notion of such a language makes no sense, they will say. To think that there could be such a language is to run afoul of that which is disclosed by grammatical investigations regarding questions such as how extensive definition works, the role of training in language acquisition, and so on, and so on. Thus, according to them, according to this variant of the standard reading, the whole point of the private language argument is to try to show us that such a language, a private language, is something that cannot be, precisely because it runs afoul of that which the investigations teaches us must be the case in order for any language so much as to be possible. So the target now is no longer the idea of an illogical language, but that of a private language. But the general shape of the conclusion is the same. A private language is something that cannot be, and not just for some contingent reason. The non-contingent character of this impossibility, and others like it, is to become manifest to us through our realizing that when we try to speak of that which we imagine might possibly be, when we imagine there could be a private language, we see that we end up speaking nonsense. And we end up speaking nonsense here because we end up violating the conditions on the possibility of meaningful discourse. Now, if the private language argument is read as proceeding in such a fashion as it standardly is, then it seems to me to be open to some version of the charge of self-made, to which we saw the Tractatus was formally alleged to be vulnerable. The argument seeks to show that the very idea of a private language is nonsensical, inherently nonsensical, and not a possible topic of discourse. But, insofar as talk of a private language is employed with the aim of advancing an argument against the possibility of such a language, the argument appears to presuppose the possibility of a language in which it's possible to speak of and frame thoughts about a private language. Thoughts such as the thought, a private language is impossible. Is the thought
that private language is impossible?
A thought, or not? Is it something thinkable? The very structure of such an argument, one that aims to show that the very idea of a private language is one that cannot make sense, presupposes some degree of intelligibility in that which it seeks to show is, perhaps in another sense, unintelligible. Now, one way around this problem is, at this point, to back off the claim that what Grammaticor and Marx seek to articulate has anything specially to do with possibilities for making sense, so that if one violates them, one's really just speaking nonsense, as opposed to speaking falsely rather than truly. And thus to back off the claim that the aim is to show the philosopher that he really lapses into nonsense when he entertains the idea of, say, a private language. Now, there's different degrees to which one can back off here. One can back all the way off this claim and claim instead that it's just an empirical truth that there can never be a private language, empirical truth rooted very deep in our natural history in some way. So then nonsense is just taken to be a colorful way of saying really false. Or a less drastic and more common strategy is to back only halfway off and to try to domesticate Wittgenstein's argument by turning into one that aims to show that the idea of a private language involves some sort of contradiction in terms. Nice 1950s Oxford style. So nonsense is taken to be a colorful way of saying something like logically or conceptually contradicting. Now, I think either of these ways of domesticating Wittgenstein's philosophical concerns begins to come free of Wittgenstein's text. That would be an exegetical matter to try to show that. And many of the commentators who do want to read Wittgenstein in such ways are alert to this. And they will often declare at such a point that much of what Wittgenstein says about grammar, about the nature of his method in philosophy, about his wanting to avoid theses, or about his aim being one of taking his interlocutor from latent to patent nonsense, and so on, is all quite unfortunate and really best disregarded if one wants to extract those bits which are really philosophically useful from his writings and put them to work in philosophy. Now, today, and so at least in the brief time I have in the talk, I'm not going to say anything directly in response to such commentators, other than just to suggest that there might be something to be gained by keeping an open mind about whether it's possible that Wittgenstein may have known what he was doing, even if it's not what you yourself want to do in philosophy. This is not to say there's anything wrong with reading a philosopher simply in order to see what useful ideas you can extract from him, and not worrying about whether he would approve of the use that you yourself want to make of those ideas. I think any philosopher worth his salt often approaches the work of other philosophers in that spirit, and Wittgenstein himself certainly often did. But maintaining the value of such an approach as I would is perfectly consistent with thinking there's also value to approaching, on a different occasion, the work of that same philosopher in a very different spirit. Namely, in a fashion that seeks to understand how he could ever have thought that the bulk of what he wrote hung together as any sort of coherent whole. How what he says about his method even seems to fit for a moment his practice of it, for example. For it's only by reading such a philosopher in such a manner that I think one's likely ever to discover the possibility of conceptions of philosophy radically different from those that are largely offered today. And I think Wittgenstein is someone that offers us the possibility of such a discovery, such an encounter, one that largely goes wasted. That doesn't mean he's then right. But there's values to discovering how deeply alien his thought is to the current thinkings of philosophy, even if one doesn't want to endorse it. To push to one side in one's reading of Wittgenstein everything having to do with his understanding of the peculiar nature of the difficulty of philosophy and the character of that difficulty being tied to the question of what it is to make sense and what happens when we fail to make sense is, I think, to deprive ourselves of the opportunity for such an encounter. Most commentators in Wittgenstein do continue to want to take seriously the idea that, for example, in the private section, language sections of the investigations, Wittgenstein's aim is to show the interlocutor that he somehow lapses into nonsense. But insofar as they seek to read these sections as advancing an argument to the conclusion that what the interlocutor wants to say must be nonsense,
These commentators are faced with the problem mentioned before, the problem of self-made, the very structure of the argument, insofar as it aims to show that the very idea of a private language is one that we cannot make sense of, seems to presuppose the intelligibility, at least in some other sense of intelligibility, of that which it also seeks to show is unintelligible. Some of the commentary, more or less explicitly, tries to get around this problem by exploring the following suggestion. Perhaps, in the private language sections, the appearance of an argument is really a ladder, which we're supposed to climb up and then throw away. But there are more and less resolute ways to construe such a suggestion. To be a proponent of some version of what I'm calling the standard reading of later Wittgenstein is to ultimately opt for an irresolute construal of that suggestion. In practice, this often means throwing away what was supposed to be, according to many proponents of the standard reading of his later work, the fundamental milestone in the progress of Wittgenstein's thought from early to late. The relatively uncontentious way to put this point would be as follows. On these readings, it turns out that later Wittgenstein did not abandon the distinction between saying and showing after all. A more contentious way might be, it turns out that later Wittgenstein is still trying to whistle it. However you put it, on the variant of the private language argument I'm now considering, Wittgenstein's strategy is not to give us an argument to the conclusion that a private language is impossible, for talk of a private language is nonsense, and a claim to the effect that what a bit of nonsense asserts is impossible is just a further bit of nonsense. So, Wittgenstein's strategy is rather to be seen as seeking to show us something which cannot be asserted in a factual or any other kind of proposition, not even a grammatical one. The thing he wants to show us, if we try to put into words, will admittedly wind up sounding something like the following remark. A private language is impossible. But, according to this unabashedly pseudo-Tractarian reading, what that remark seeks to convey is a kind of insight that cannot really be conveyed by an ordinary assertoric proposition. On this reading of later Wittgenstein, the grammatical propositions of the investigations are at least tacitly held to possess all the following pseudo-Tractarian characteristics. They seek to give voice to truths which are not garden variety truths. What thus comes into fact, or view, are not facts. These truths are, strictly speaking, unassertable. The propositions that attempt to state them nonetheless serve a useful purpose. This purpose is achieved by directing our attention to features of language and or reality that undergird the possibility of meaningful discourse. And in this way, they enable us to see matters aright. Now, such readers of later Wittgenstein will do their best to describe their own reading of Wittgenstein in ways that disguises the extent of its pseudo-Tractarian character, extent that I've been trying to bring out. They don't want their reading of later Wittgenstein to sound too much like their reading of the Tractatus. They'll admit to some degree of parallelism, but they will do their best to emphasize features of later Wittgenstein's philosophical practice, which highlights the differences between later Wittgenstein and their reading of him, and early Wittgenstein and their reading of him. They will emphasize the role of examples and the attention to the use of language in the work of later Wittgenstein. They will emphasize the insistence upon the existence of a multiplicity of grammars and the importance of the role played by an attention to the motley of kinds of language game in the later work. They will emphasize that language games are instances of language use interwoven with human activity, and everything turns an appreciation of how deeply context-dependent each such instance of language use is, and so on, and so on. And they'll attempt to draw upon all of these differences in the descriptions they offer of what is shown by later Wittgenstein and how it is shown, so that it sounds very little like their descriptions of the activity by means of which the Tractatus allows us to grasp that which is shown but cannot be said. But the point of what's proceeded so far is the following. The true measure of how pseudo-Tractarian a reading of later Wittgenstein is not to be gauged by the vocabulary in which it is couched. You can replace talk of logical syntax with grammar, language with language games, application with use, elucidation with investigation, and so on and so on, and still wind up attributing a doctrine to later Wittgenstein that is mired in the essentially pseudo-Tractarian problematic. Now, so far, I've just attempted to bring out how deep the parallels run between standard readings of early and later Wittgenstein. The parallel begins at H stage with the idea that Wittgenstein is concerned to show that there is something that cannot be. There cannot be an illogical language. There cannot be a private language. Or if we had uncertainty, there cannot be a practice of knowing and doubting whose framework judgments are themselves candidates for knowledge or doubt. But to think this is the locus of significant continuity is, I think, to miss what the real continuity that I'm here trying to bring out in Wittgenstein's philosophy is, one that's nicely summarized in section 374 of the Investigations, where he says, quote, "The great difficulty here is not to represent the matter as if there was something one could not do. The idea that Wittgenstein's aim is to show us that there is something we cannot do goes hand in hand with the tendency to read Wittgenstein at each stage of his career as seeking to adumbrate the conditions of meaningful speech. In each case, Wittgenstein's aim is taken to be one of showing the philosopher that he's speaking nonsense because he's violated certain conditions, be they conditions of syntax, grammar, of our linguistic practice, or whatever. And the integrity of Wittgenstein's method of philosophical criticism thereby comes to appear to require that he first be able to specify what the conditions in question are. And this requirement, in turn, gives rise to the appearance that he must be committed to the existence of a set of quasi-truths, be they called the principles of logical syntax, the rules of grammar, or the judgments that constitute the framework of our practice, and that these mark the bounds of sense and reveal the exact point at which the philosopher strayed beyond them. These quasi-truths must lie outside the realm of merely empirical truths, while lying just inside the limit beyond which the realm of impermissible philosophical nonsense begins. And once the question arises, what sort of truth it is that these quasi-truths can be said to possess, I think the waffling and dithering begins. Now, I've termed the reading of the Tractatus, briefly sketched at the beginning of this paper, pseudo-tractarian, in order to be able to distinguish it from the reading of that work that I myself favor and had elsewhere defended. All I'll say now is that I think the crucial difference that matters here is a difference in the readings of the conception of nonsense that's there put forward in that work. This, of course, has consequences for how one understands what he's asking us to do at the end of the book, when he says the reader has come to recognize the propositions of the work as nonsensical. I will prescind from all of that right now and just focus on what the Tractatus has to say about what is distinctive about its own conception of nonsense. This is section 5.4733. Quote, Frege says, "Every legitimately constructed proposition must have a sense. And I say, every possible proposition is legitimately constructed. And if it has no sense, this can only be because we have given no meaning to some of its constituent parts." I want to draw attention to the word "only" in this passage. The critical difference between the formulation attributed to Frege and the one which the Tractatus endorses is that the former implicitly distinguishes between propositions that are legitimately constructed and those that are not, while the latter rejects the idea that there is such a thing as a logically illegitimately constructed proposition. Quote, "Every possible proposition is legitimately constructed. And the only indicates that there's only one way for a proposition to fail to have meaning, where we might have thought there were at least two." Now, what does it mean to reject the idea that there could be logically illegitimately constructed propositions? Or to put the same question differently, what does early Wittgenstein mean when he says in the previous section, quote, "We cannot give a sign or wrong sense," unquote? I've argued elsewhere that I think Wittgenstein saw here a tension in Frege between two different conceptions of nonsense, which I've called the substantial conception and the austere conception, respectively. The substantial conception distinguishes between two different kinds of nonsense, mere nonsense and substantial nonsense. Mere nonsense is simply unintelligible. It expresses no thought. Substantial nonsense, though composed of intelligible ingredients, combines them in an illegitimate way. It expresses a logically incoherent thought, you might say. And according to substantial conception, these two kinds of nonsense are logically distinct. The former is mere gibberish, where the latter involves what commentators are fond of calling a violation of logical syntax, though you will not find that form of words anywhere in the Church Times. And the austere conception holds that mere nonsense is, from a logical point of view, the only kind of nonsense there is. The Tractatus is standardly read as championing the substantial conception, and I think that is to mistake the bait for the hook, to mistake the target of the work for its doctrine. Rather, I think the Tractatus seeks to resolve the tension in Frege's thought between these two conceptions in favor of the austere view. And the presence of the word only in 5.4733, that I drew your attention to, is Wittgenstein signaling his rejection of the substantial conception. Now, we're ready to take up in conclusion. This is different from inserting into an English sentence a meaningless word, say, abracadabra. Every word in the first sentence is English, and we shall be inclined to say the sentence has a meaning. The sentence with a nonsense word, or the string of nonsense words, can be discarded from our language. But if we discard from our language a sentence like, I steal Smith's toothache, that seems to be quite different. The second seems nonsense, we are tempted to say, because of some truth about the nature of things, or the nature of the world. We seem to discover in some way that what pains and personality do not fit together. And they do not fit together in such a way that I can feel as pain. Now, it's a Gedankenschrift. And then, the task will be to show that there is in fact no difference between these two cases of nonsense. Though there is a psychological distinction, in that we are inclined to say the one and be puzzled by it, and not the other. We constantly hover between regarding it as sense and regarding it as nonsense. And hence the trouble arises. Now, for a resolute reader of Wittgenstein, whatever differences there are in the evolution that are thrown up by the evolution of Wittgenstein's thought, and there are many, Wittgenstein's description here of his task after that Gedankenstrich, that is, to show that there is no principal logical, or we could say grammatical difference, between these two cases of nonsense, will seem an equally accurate as a task of the, as a description of the task of his early and his later philosophy. To see what's at stake here, recall that according to the standard reading of the so-called private language argument, Wittgenstein's aim was supposedly to show, one, that the possibility of language use rests in certain conditions, two, a private language doesn't satisfy those conditions, three, therefore such a language is impossible. Now such a reading of the private language argument takes the aim to be to show that the very idea of a private language is the idea of something which we can rule out because of the kind of sense that the locution private language has antecedently been given in our reflections. It takes it that there is something determined which the philosopher wants to mean by that locution, and that is nonsense. Now, there are, of course, all kinds of perfectly determined things one might mean in speaking of a private language. I might tell you that I've just invented a private language. I'm its only speaker. But if you're nice to me, I might consider teaching it to you. But of course, that's not the kind of thing the philosopher wants to mean by a private language. True enough. Why not? Because, we'll be told, it's not private enough. Wittgenstein says his topic is, quote, the language which describes my inner experiences and which only I myself can understand, unquote. And we'll be told that the right way to understand what's at issue there is to understand that a private language is the sort of language which is impossible for anyone but me to understand. But what does that mean? And as we go on, we will be told there's a right way of understanding what Wittgenstein here means by private language. And it's the sort of thing that he's concerned to show cannot be. There is therefore supposed to be a determinate something that is the thing the philosopher does want to mean, that Wittgenstein is taken to be interested first in singling out, in order to second then show that that is something that the philosopher cannot mean because it is nonsense. On any such analysis of what is at issue here, what the philosopher means must be shown to be not mere nonsense, but substantial nonsense. Now, what would a reading of the relevant sections of Philosophical Investigations look like that didn't attribute to Wittgenstein a commitment to the substantial conception? A resolute reader of this stretch of Wittgenstein's later work will want to begin by pointing out that what Wittgenstein nowhere says there cannot be a private language. The discussion of private language, like so many similar passages in Wittgenstein's later work, begins with an invitation to the reader to try to imagine something. The point of the exercise is not to get us to see that there is something determinate for us to imagine, which we are then supposed to see is the sort of thing that cannot be. The limits of imagination do not outrun the limits of sense, Wittgenstein says elsewhere. Rather, the point of the exercise is to get us to see that there is nothing for us to mean by the locution private language that corresponds to what we, under the pressure of certain philosophical perplexities, took ourselves to be able to mean by it. There are, of course, various things we can mean by these words, but they don't answer to our philosophical desires. And as long as there hovers before us the seeming possibility of something further to mean that does promise to thus answer to our desires, the philosopher's treatment of the question of a private language remains unfinished. The point of the exercise of trying to imagine a, quote, private language, unquote, is to work through the seeming possibility here, to think it all the way through until we find it dissolves in us. Thus far, there is a parallel, I think, between the Tractatus and his later work. The transition from latent to patent nonsense is the point of this exercise. The task is to help us to see how the seeming possibility of a, quote, private language, unquote, dissolves under the pressure of an attempt to work out what it seemingly requires. And what makes a reading of this bit of Wittgenstein's text resolute, in my parlance, is that it follows all the way through in such an exercise to the point at which the apparent something dissolves into a nothing. And this is something the reader must do. It is work left for the reader to do himself. And what will make a reading irresolute is that, evading such work, instead, it continues to cling to the idea that there is something determinate which the words private language and a philosophical employment of them are trying but failing to mean. And that Wittgenstein's aim is to show his interlocutor that that is the sort of thing that cannot be, which then causes us to look for arguments that Wittgenstein failed to supply to yield the required conclusion. To fail to see how different these two ways of reading Wittgenstein are is, I think, to fail to see what is at stake in his work, what sort of treatment of philosophical problems he seeks to offer, both early and late. Just read my final three sentences. But then, you might ask, where does the change in his philosophy come? Why do the instruments of logical symbolism become so irrelevant to his later concern? Why, indeed, does he later look upon the sorts of instruments like a Begriffsschrift, which played such a crucial role in his earlier conception of philosophical elucidation, now with suspicion? And in what way does he take his earlier self, as he evidently does, to have been seduced by a vision of the crystalline purity of logic? And why does the manner in which his philosophical work is written undergo such a radical transformation? Why does he come to reject the strategy of offering the reader a single continuous ladder which he is to climb up and then throw away? I think these are the right questions to ask, but I believe it's only once one has attained a sufficiently resolute view of where some of the fundamental continuities in Wittgenstein's philosophy lie, one of which I've tried to sketch today, that it even begins to become possible to make real progress with questions such as these, and thus to begin to see where the real and genuine discontinuities are also to be found. Thank you.